Hey, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. It's Jim Hoffman here from EMS Office Hours. I want to thank you, of course, for joining me for this live show. And if you're listening to a recording, of course, thank you for taking the time to either download it or listen to it in iTunes or on Blog Talk Radio or on the blog at emsofficehours.com. Today, I'm just going to talk a little bit about partners in EMS and communication with partners. And I'm going to try to make it a little bit of a short series and kind of focus on individuals that we work with kind of hand in hand in EMS. And tonight, I want to focus on medics, and whether you're an EMT that works with a medic or a paramedic that works dual medics, or even if you're a nurse that happens to be listening in and deal with paramedics in the emergency room, I think this might be a good episode for you to maybe get some tips on dealing with your partners and communicating with other paramedics in the field and how we can do it to better facilitate patient care and our careers and our day-to-day activities in EMS. So, you know, it's a common point that we bring up a lot of times on EMS Office Hours is how we kind of own a lot of what we do. And, you know, this communication, again, it can actually cause issues with patient care and daily operations. So I want to try to focus a little bit on this topic and kind of maybe break it down a little bit so that we can kind of focus on the little differences that there really is when it comes to being a paramedic or an EMT or a nurse or a doctor and how we communicate with each individual one here. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. But before I do want to go ahead and mention I was at an EMS Education Day for EMS Week. And pretty good educational day, a lot of great topics, a lot of good docs that was speaking during this education day. It was at Albany Medical Center here in upstate New York, and it was about an eight-hour day. It was a pretty long day, you know, listening to lectures and all. But, you know, they fed us lunch and they fed us breakfast, which was pretty cool. And we got some giveaways, and I've been to one before, and they gave us some pretty interesting giveaways, and they have some vendors that show up. But one giveaway is actually, I looked in the bag and I found a pair of scissors and a pen light and things like that. But I also found a Wantanoo oxygen wrench. And as you know, Josh Knapp, who joins me, you've been joining me here weekly on Office Hours, he produces this wrench, and it was actually a TK3 version of this wrench, which I thought was pretty cool because, you know, these wrenches are about $12 a pop. And I thought it was pretty interesting that the medical center spent the money for those wrenches to give out as a giveaway. There's about 300 people to this event, and they have two other events the night before and night after, which might have also been giving away the wrench as well. So I'm hoping that, you know, for Josh and get that wrench out there and more people looking at it. And I'll tell you, a lot of the people speaking about that wrench during the show, overhearing them and speaking to a couple people there when I was there, had nothing but good things to say. So really great feedback, and it's kind of good to know that the product of this is getting out there and that you know, there's some attention to it, and the attention is positive. So right now I'm going to bring Josh, and I believe I have Tim Noonan on line with me as well. Go ahead and get some conversation going here. Josh, Tim, you guys with me?
Hey, Tim, how you doing tonight?
How you guys doing?
Hey, Tim.
Tim, before we get started, do you work with EMT or you work with dual medic where you are?
Medic EMT.
Okay. I just want to try to focus a little bit tonight, guys. I don't know if you listened to the intro or not. But just talk a little bit how we interact with our medic partners, you know, and how, you know, if you're an EMT or working with a medic or perhaps a medic working with another medic or even your coworkers that you wind up being on calls with on trauma calls or critical calls, and maybe you get a paramedic backing you up on the scene, you know, how we communicate with each other, how that translates to the patient care we're giving, translates into the perception of, you know, can be with people that are watching how we communicate with each other. And one thing I wanted to mention first, which I think is a pretty big thing, is personality. and you know how personalities can actually clash on scenes. But I'm wondering what you guys think, and how big of a role does that actually play when it comes to things like I mentioned, as far as patient care and how we appear to the public and interact with each other.
There's some sort of background noise going on. I don't know if that's on your end or my end.
I'm not sure. Tim, are you outside or inside?
I'm driving.
Oh, that's probably what we're hearing. That's probably what we're hearing.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, Jim, you know, communication is the root of what we do. And if you think about it, when we're trying to figure out a call and talking to a patient, you know, one of the things that separates the good from the really good from the adequate is communication skills. You know, can you put your patient at ease? Can you understand what's going on with them? Can you relate to what they're trying to tell you? Or even if you can't relate to it, can you at least understand it? And, you know, when I first started in a business a long time ago, I remember somebody telling me, listen, you know, the Lord gave you one mouth and two ears. And there's a reason for that. And the root of good communication is you must listen to what the other person is saying. So if you're going to start with anything, that would probably be the root. Now, if you're talking about, you know, if personalities, I think the biggest aspect of personalities is maturity. If somebody's not going to act in an adult manner, it's going to be difficult to communicate with them. Jim?
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking. I'm wondering though. You know, sometimes we don't always get to have steady partners. A lot of times, you know, and occasionally you don't really have the luxury sometimes to feel out somebody or to get to know them on a personal level and gauge what their personality actually is. And
right.
You know, it's hard to gauge that until you're actually on a call. And you start seeing, like, you know, how they act on a call. And, you know, some people have that personality where they want to take over the entire call. Some people have the personality where they just kind of step back and let you lead the call. Some people have that bump in the log where they'll do nothing unless you absolutely direct them to do something. You know, and I think those different types of attitudes that people can have when you get in, you know, that might be great when you're talking to them in the crew room or in the front of the ambulance, but then you get on the call and it seems like all of a sudden you meet this new person. You know what I mean? You're meeting
yeah.
like the real person, not the representative that you were talking to for, you know, for the past 2 hours. And you know, I think that this type of where it becomes to be a surprise, it can end up affecting the patient care, can end up affecting the entire call unless you maybe can somehow try to address it beforehand.
Oh, you're 100% on the mark. I mean, if the other person, you know, that's the thing. You know, everybody in this business, when you see that new guy walking up and you know, pulling on the bus door, you know, there's that initial, like, tension, like, unless you know them, if you've never seen them before and they're coming up, they're in your company's uniform, they know which bus to go to, and they're your assigned partner, well, surprise, surprise. And so you don't know what you're getting, but it's sort of your communication sort of starts there, doesn't it? I mean, if you sort of set up and say, listen, we're going to be, you know, working together, let's, you know, set a couple of ground rules between us so we know what we're doing. You know, I've had partners who, when you're teching and, you know, they just write and the driver does all the setup, line setups, and medication draws and all, everything like that, because you're concentrating on your patient care. So you're going to be interacting with the patient. You're going to be looking at the medicines they take. You're going to be writing up the ACR. So you're going to have most of the exchange with the patient. Now, I've had partners who just walk in and, you know, try to walk all over you, try to, you know, do everything. And I'll be honest with you, there are times when it's a nonsense job and it's a non-critical that came in and somehow got to the ALS status. And you're just like, knock yourself out, dude, you know. But the trouble is that sort of sets the rhythm for the rest of the trip.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, Tim, you said you work with EMTs primarily as a partner, but what about when you get on those calls, you have medics that are there to assist you? Do you wind up, maintaining control of the scene? I imagine, knowing you, I imagine you try to keep control of the entire scene because you're a patient. But do you have issues at all when you have other medics who try to step on what you're trying to do?
I try to remain as laid back as possible, actually, because I think the more you try to control things, the less control you have.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where we screw up most often, is we try to act like we're in control when we're not controlling a lot.
Good point.
One of the things I would recommend for an EMT working with a medic is when the medic's acting a little bit differently, you know, step back and try to see what's different, because they're probably picking up on something about the patient that is looking sicker than what they may be noticing. And same thing for the medic. A lot of times the EMT is the more experienced one at picking up on, you know, subtle presentations of an unstable patient. And you know, communication between the medic and the EMT can be very important on that. I like to, you know, take a much more relaxed approach to things, you know, what's going on, how are you doing today, and let the patient determine where things go. But there are other times when I see something that says, okay, I want to ask questions in this specific area and figure out what's going on here because something doesn't look right. And go ahead.
Joe, I mean, if I understood Jim's question correctly, he's really talking about our approach when we're dealing with another partner. And I think that your aspect of saying that I'm going to be laid back, I'm going to let things flow, you're absolutely right. The more we're all type A people, and the more we try to control, the less we can really get our hands around. You know, when it comes to patient care, what do you do when, if you're sort of running the call and your partner or the person who's joined you on scene starts, even though they don't have the same skill set or level of training that you do, starts trying to take over
Even if it's the medic trying to take it over, it can be a problem.
Sure.
Usually what I've done is say, okay, I want to do things a bit differently. I don't think we should do that, or I think we should do this, let's contact medical command and see what they do. Unfortunately, that has not worked out very well for me. well, things like, I want to go to the children's hospital because kid is unstable. Closest hospital is a couple of minutes away. The children's hospital is 20 to 30 minutes away. It's a no-brainer for me. You go the extra 20, 30 minutes to get the kid to the children's hospital rather than go to the closest hospital where they're going to be possibly able to deal with it, but more likely freaked out by an unstable kid because that's not what they do.
Yeah, they end up transferring them anyway because of the fact that they can't handle it. And
now
they
can't admit them.
Right.
If you don't have pediatricians on staff and the child needs to be admitted, eventually you have to transfer the kid rather than admit the kid and, you know, find them
right.
A room upstairs. There is no room upstairs for them.
I guess we're a little luckier in New York, Tim, because we don't really – a lot of our patient transport decisions are sort of set in our protocols or in the fire department rules on where to transport. And so there's really not an argument if a kid – I mean, where the arguments come in, I guess, is in a provider aspect. Is this person really stable or unstable? Do they need to – is this a real trauma or not? I mean, I've had, you know, the proverbial all-state-itis fender bender where the person is complaining of neck and back pain, and there's barely a scratch on the bumper. You know, we're not mm-hmm. talking about anything going on. And then I'm saying, well, you know what? Listen, this qualify, even though they're going on a backboard, it's not a trauma. It's not a multi-system trauma. You know, this person doesn't need to go to a trauma center. And I've been adamantly opposed by some partners who think that any time that you have the description in the call type of trauma, well, then you must go to a trauma center. And, you know, that's...
Well, there are certain words for people like that, but they're not really polite, and they probably don't improve communication.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah.
I think Tim does make a good point, though, when you talk about working with somebody else and the personality aspect where, you know, rather than jumping in and trying to take control where you can actually wind up, you know, that can cause more friction, is to kind of let the patient really dictate what you're doing, you know, go over what the patient's saying, where they want to be transported to, things like that, and kind of let that dictate the path so that your partner, as far as personalities go and any kind of conflicts about how they want to maybe, you know, more aggressively treat somebody or less aggressively treat somebody, kind of let the patient dictate that rather than you trying to dictate it.
So well, it's not always easy to do.
No, it's
not. I had
not.
One call where it was a CHF patient, and most of the medications that were appropriate were contraindicated for one thing or another, allergies and other medications. So, you know, basically it was oxygen and move quickly to the hospital. The medic who was with me wanted to intubate the patient, and I said, no, you know, there is a lot of respiratory distress. When the patient is having respiratory distress, we can assist the patient with the bag valve mask and hold off until we get to the hospital where, you know, this can be done with paralytics and, you know, in a way that is more appropriate. This was before CPAP, in a way that is more appropriate for this patient. And the medic wanted to attempt nasal intubation, did a few times, and was not successful, but the patient did all right without the tube, because, you know, since the tube never ended up in the right place, you know, we had to go basically with what I wanted, just a little bit bloodier.
Yeah. Well, but let me turn this a little bit around and just say, what do you do when, I mean, what are some of the things that you apply or the skills that you apply in terms of communication now, if you're sort of getting that, you know, that wall or not even that wall, that miscommunication from a partner, or and it doesn't have to be a new partner, it's from any partner. I mean, do you do certain things in order to try to bridge that gap? Because I know I do. I mean, I certainly try. I'm not always successful, but sometimes you can do things, you know, like pick out something, like when you talk about the call, you know, you say, hey, listen, and start out with something that went right about the call. I really liked how you introduced yourself and went right for their medications. I was able to start vitals and, you know, hook up the monitor. But, you know, this whole aspect of when they were starting to progress, you know, that was really my call. You know, can you see it from my side? And,
well, you tend to do that after the call, but I think it's much more important to figure out ways to deal with this during the call.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, you have to be, it's the type of thing, like, during the call where you don't want to be, you have to kind of put up that united front in front of the patients where you can't
right.
really show that you guys are, you know, conflicting on the treatment path, you know, because that is going to totally not give you any type of trust when it comes to you know, the patient looking at you, like, what
well,
the hell are you guys doing?
With that, if I think that I think that the other medic on scene is trying to over-treat the patient, that works in my favor. That works in the patient's favor.
Yeah, but, you know, you're still sort of, you know, you want to, I agree with Jim, you really want to keep that united front going, and
I mean, I think there's a way that, you know, when it comes to the treatment, I think it's going to it depends upon, like, when you want to step in, when you want to try to, you know, either direct it one way or the other or disagree with what's going on, what type of treatment is going to be getting given, if it's something that is going to hurt the patient, when you're going to want to. That's why I think where it comes where we have to actually be more aggressive in what we're doing, you know, you know, approaching our partner to say, listen, I don't think this is something that we should do. This is what I would do in this situation. And I think Tim made a good point, too, where, you know, if you get to that disagreement, you can always just say, well, why don't we run it by medic control and see what they say, and then, you know, and go with that. And this way it's not like you're fighting with each other on the scene. You're kind of putting it to a doctor's, consult. You know, the patient would see that. A little more professional than the two of you kind of bickering as far as what type of drug you're going to give somebody.
Right, but if you think about communication, Jim, you're really talking about now going to third-party mitigation when you say, well, we're going to call medical control or something. But, I mean, what would you do if you're faced with that and your first impulse that might get that might bridge that communication gap on scene in front of the patient, not seeming to be confrontational? I mean, I sort of look at the partner and say, you know, would you consider this treatment as well? Or, you know, don't you think that maybe we could hold off or that use that as a backup? This is the way that we should go for our primary course of action. I'm shouting here.
That's all right. I think that, I mean, I've had calls where, you know, I've had one call was a cardiac arrest call, and it was me, my medic partner, and a couple of EMTs, and actually a fitting lieutenant was on the scene with us, and my partner started trying to give medications that were not in the protocol and not warranted for the patient's condition, and you know, the lieutenant is going along with it, and I had to actually, and I actually wound up saying, you know, maybe we should hold off on that and, you know, think about this protocol and where we're at with this patient. And then I kind of like brought the lieutenant out of his excitement of the whole entire call and kind of brought him back to, you know, to ground level where he could say, okay, you know what, I gotta stop getting caught up in what's going on and take a step back and think about what this patient is going on with this patient and how they need to be treated for their condition. And then he was actually able to go ahead and tell my partner, why don't you hold off on that drug right now? You know what I mean? So, I mean, there's ways, I think, to do it. And I think it's important that, you know, this communication type thing, it does go on with our partners. You know, too many times I think people just kind of just let their partner take over, do whatever, and then after the call start, you know, bad-mouthing them behind their back because they didn't do what they wanted them to do, or they were working outside the protocol, or you know, something like that, rather than trying to mitigate it or communicate at the time or even beforehand to set the guidelines as to who's doing what and who's in charge and you know, what the call, how the call is going to get run.
Right. Right.
You know?
But, you know, you were sort of bringing sanity to a situation that could have turned into a really bad situation for everybody involved. I mean, once you start giving medication that's not part of the treatment, whether it's in protocol or not, you're going down a path that you can't recover from.
Yeah, I mean,
isn't that what this is about?
Right.
When you're disagreeing with somebody else about what the right treatment is. Is there any treatment that we can give that is completely safe?
Right, but I...
Well, not really.
I think there's two ways of going around that. It's one way is an absolute confrontational way, and the other way is a suggestive way of saying, you know, let's look at this, or, let's look back. Is this really the medications we need in the protocol? The other way is if you're dealing with somebody who's completely obstinate and will not budge from their position and is drawing up medications, you literally, you have to get involved. You have to stop them from doing that, even at the detriment of not showing a united front or possibly scaring your patient, because you know what? The alternative is you cannot do that task. You can't give drugs that you're not supposed to be giving.
Yeah, you know, I agree. In the case I was talking about with the patient who had just gone into cardiac arrest and did a couple rounds of CPR, intubated the patient, had an IV established, and I was actually starting the IV, and my partner was getting ready to put epi down the tube. This went back when we were doing that, and I looked over at the monitor, and the patient had a rhythm, they had a pulse, and I had actually stop her from doing it, and saying maybe we should check for pulse, we should think about what we're doing here before we start putting that down the tube, But she was caught up in the protocol of, okay, I have to intubate, now I got to put some drugs down the tube, my partner doesn't have the line yet, and that type of thing, and getting caught up in the, three epi, three atropine, and let's go to the hospital, let's call for a pronouncement type thing.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily your partner or classic tunnel vision.
Well,
I mean,
that's what I'm saying. That's the type of tunnel vision you have to kind of, sometimes that's part of the issue, I guess, is people get into that, also get into that thing, too, where they're just trying to follow protocols, and they feel that's the safest way to, practice being a paramedic, is just kind of follow those step by step. So I'm going to do A, B after A, and then C and D and whatever. I'm not going to get in trouble. I'm not going to, hurt anybody, and I'm not going to be questioned or ridiculed as long as I follow protocols,
And you can involve the patient and say, hey, these are some of the treatments that we can provide to you, and these are the advantages and disadvantages that are associated with the treatment, and, let the patient make a decision. Informed consent and informed refusal should go along with every treatment if the patient has the capacity to make those decisions.
Oh, Tim, you're not going to get an argument on that, but that's like a perfect world scenario. If you got a guy who's, three-quarters full APE, breathing at 40 times a minute with, a cardiac history, you can't say, well, these are the costs, these are the benefits
True.
Of what I want to do to you, But if
but
you're...
I wouldn't put them in the category of having the capacity to make these decisions at that time.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. I think like you mentioned early on, as far as involving the patient, having the patient dictate it, that's when the patient isn't your classic critical patient who really needs intervention that they might not necessarily understand, but you don't necessarily have the time to explain it, or they don't have the maybe even have the capacity to understand the full breadth of it. I mean, how many times do you try to put CPAP on patients in CHF, and they're trying to, they want nothing to do with that, but yet that CPAP can actually save their life, can prevent them from getting intubated and things like that. But, trying to explain that to them when they can't breathe and they're hypoxic and they're trying to pull that mask away is,
ask them to hold the mask on their own face before you strap it down. And
right.
That way they have more control over it. And once you realize that it's helping, that they're starting to feel a little bit bad, then you ask, do you mind if I strap it on now? And anybody who's had CPAP before usually is very cooperative.
Oh, yeah.
Once
right.
They see the CPAP, because they know how effective it can be.
Well, but, we're talking, again, not necessarily our communication with the patient, but our communication with our partner. And we're not talking under this situation where you're working with, you know, your favorite partner. They know what you're thinking. You know what you know what they're thinking, and you've done this job 1,000 times before. And even if you've never done this job before, you know how they're going to react in that situation. I mean, we're dealing with, the complication.
I'm just thinking too, while I think, like you said, I mean, we're trying to focus a little bit on the medic partner that you might have. Sometimes I think in order to facilitate your communication with them is you can involve the patient to get your point across a little bit as to what you want to, what you want to see done or what you want to see not done. And that comes to as far with patient care and decisions that we're making and drawing lines during patient care so we have a good outcome with the patient. And a lot of the times it's not going to matter whether or not your partner starts a 20-gauge catheter IV or an 18-gauge catheter IV and what your preference would be. That's not really going to make that much of a difference. And maybe this is the type of thing you can discuss with your partner after the call as far as what you would have done and necessity of starting a larger bore, intravenous and rather than starting something a little bit smaller. And you talk about skills and, your partner's abilities on them and versus the patient's need for the skill, and when do we step in as a partner and say, hey, listen, I think this is a little bit too aggressive for this patient.
Right, right. It's kind of interesting. I was looking up sort of rules of communication and getting a couple of them together. And it's sort of funny. The best set of rules for communication it happens to be on a marriage website, but it really does apply, if you think about it, to your partner. I mean, and I'll read you out these 10 rules. It says be sure your spouse is listening. And that's sort of the first rule, isn't it, that we have to listen to what they're saying. Begin with something positive, so you want to be reinforcing. Don't attack because you're going to put them on the defensive. Don't exaggerate because, again, that puts people on the defensive. Don't try to mind read what the other person's saying or what the other person's thinking. Focus on what you want or on the preferences, not on the principles. Explain what made you do what you did, or if you're explaining something you're doing, clarify your need. Limit yourself to one or two topics and allow time for some questions and some back and forth. And it's kind of interesting; those rules really do apply if you're on the bus.
Sure, I think too. I think it's also important, that even with getting married, you've got this part before you get married as far as dating and things like that, where you're even setting boundaries. And I think this is something we have to do as well, especially with people that we're not familiar with, and what their personalities are and things like that, is to set those boundaries before the call. I mean, a lot of times you get those people where, they're new, you don't really know them. And if you find – I always get a sense that when they're not really – help me check out the ambulance, they're not really engaged in what the ambulance, is looking like and things like that, I start getting the feeling, they're not really engaged in the job. And that when we get on this call, I start getting a sense that they're going to not really be – engaged in the assignment and just kind of, looking to just get through it and not really being a partner, just kind of being a chauffeur, just kind of being somebody that's standing there and hands me the medication bottles, know.
So God, that's not a good feeling.
I think we should set boundaries for the call with people that we don't really know, and this way when we have, we can kind of get away from issues with personality issues.
Yeah, I mean, but that was sort of what I alluded to at the beginning of this segment, Jim, was that, when you get that new person and you're first meeting them for the first time, you sort of, bring out some ground rules of how you're going to operate. And you don't have to say, okay, the second you close this ambulance door, these are the ground rules for how we're going to work. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'd tell the guy to take a flying leap. I might even get out. It's just like, what are you talking to me like that for? But if you do it in a way that's like conversational and just saying, hey, you know, how's things going? Have you worked this bus before? Have you worked other buses? Where, you know, this is where I come from. Where do you come from? I like to work this way, you know, and you sort of slip it in there in a non-confrontational way of just saying, hey, this is how I like to work. This is how my approach to patient care is. What's yours? You know, and maybe you can figure out a game plan ahead of time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you can't sit there and start barking out how you want each call to go. I mean, it's good to know, saying, okay, listen, you know, are you going to handle the patient care on this call, or am I going to handle that, and you're going to do the documentation, or, you know, how are we going to run this? And this way, it's a little clearer. I mean, I worked, you know, in the city, and we were dual medics, and now I work where it's one medic, one EMT, but I still have occasional where I work with the dual medic, you know, truck. So I, you know, I have both ends of it, and you do have to handle the EMT end of a little bit differently. And when I work with an EMT and I do get calls where I have another medic on scene, I mean, I do get a little bit of anxiety when the other medic is there, because I don't know who they are. A lot of times they're from another agency altogether, and I'm not sure what to expect from them. You know, I'm not sure what to expect as far as, are they going to try to take over the call? Are they going to try to start dictating what I'm doing? Things like that. So I try to, you know, keep that in the back of my mind. So when I do come on scene, you know, I try to give them a rundown right away so that they know that I'm in control. They know that I know what the hell's going on and what I've done so far, and not just actually treat them as if they're just in the body on scene to give me a hand. You know, so I think that's something that we can do for, you know, other medics that come on scene and we might not necessarily know, is by giving them like a triage report almost of what's happening with the patient. Kind of just kind of asserts that you're the one, that this is your patient, you're in control of what's going on, and this is what you need them to do, and kind of set the tone a little bit that way, without being, of course, you know, being bossy, but just kind of setting that tone from the get-go so that as the scene progresses, you don't have any issues, you know, cropping up.
You know what? I was sort of thinking of what you were saying, Jim, and I got to say, don't we sort of start that communication going straight up in terms of when we get on the bus and you look at your partner and you say tech or drive? I mean,
right.
I don't know if you work that way up often or not, but you know what I'm talking about.
Well, when I work with an EMT, a lot of times I do most of the teching.
Okay. Right.
You know, when I work with another medic, we usually alternate the calls. You know, we'll alternate, each call will be alternated, whoever, you know, we'll just switch back and forth. But we still have to work with the team. You know, you still have to think about, you know, the skills that are going on. And again, what I mentioned a little bit earlier, you know, your ability to do something versus the need to do something, and, you know, when to kind of step in. And that can be a lot of times when you have newer paramedics that want to really jump in and start doing all the cool stuff they learned in school, because now they're on their own and they don't have a preceptor stopping them. But, you know, you know, you still have to kind of, you know, set those ground rules, I think, you know, with these people.
One of the things you can do with a medic partner is if they start taking over the call, say, you know, do you want to run this call? And as
right.
long as you're not disagreeing on treatment,
right.
you know, you can just switch up and, like, I'll do the next one and let them run the call. Maybe it's a type of call that really appeals to them. Maybe I like doing CHF calls. A lot of people don't like it for, you know, a variety of reasons. Some people say they never see CHF patients. I think they just don't recognize them when they see them. But, you know, it's a call that can require a lot more thought than your basic trauma call. So,
right.
And that's where I get most of my enjoyment, while other people say, oh, a stabbing.
Right.
Like, hey, knock yourself out.
Well,
on
you know, a lot
hand,
of EMS are trauma junkies.
Well, yeah, but oh. usually that is something that goes away, or maybe they just haven't done one in a while, and, you know, everybody's different. You know, some days you're in the mood for trauma.
Right, right. Well, there's no doubt about that. I like your approach in terms of, and I've been there myself, where it's like, you know, if it's really a one-person call, you know, and not everybody's moving asses and elbows, then, you know, if, hey, look, you know, you seem to really get into this call, you want to take it, you want to do it, but take the paperwork and do it too, because I'm not going to write up what you're doing. I mean, if you're really going to run this call. And that's, you know, one of the things Jim and I had a previous conversation about was, you know, like the partner who gets in, wants to do everything, wants to dictate how everything's done, and then leaves you as a scribe. I'm sorry, that's not how it works.
That I've run into with people who want to fly patients, and too often they're officers from the company. They show up and they're like, oh, we got to fly this patient, who generally doesn't even come close to meeting flight criteria, and almost always I've worked within 45 minutes drive time of a trauma center, so there's almost no reason to fly anybody. Like, okay, you want to fly them? Maybe you want to write this call because my chart is not going to reflect this being anywhere near appropriate for a flight.
Right. But the mechanism of injury, though. That's
just yeah. I had yeah. one partner who to drive to the trauma center and insisted that we fly the patient. And you know, what can I do about that?
Right.
Well, I wasn't going to leave the patient in my partner's hands because the partner required a lot of pain medicine. And my partner also wrote me up on that call for giving too much morphine, even though I had called command, just not while my partner was watching me.
Right.
And the medical command doctor backed me up, and, well, that was the end of that medic at that agency.
Well, you know what? It's like that's one of those situations where you have inherent distrust between partners, and that's a brutal time to do any call. Because if you don't trust your partner and you're looking to get them, or they're looking to get you, that just sucks, and there's no two
ways
about
that. I don't know what the goal of that partner was. We disagree a lot about philosophy. I know it's somebody who cares a lot about patients. We just have different ways of expressing that on a call. And this is a medic who, as the head medic at one agency, goes for rules that don't allow for any discretion. Like, okay, on every call that's dispatched as ALS, the medic will be in the back because we can't trust a medic to determine that this is a BLS call because they'll make everything BLS because medics are lazy. Like, no, you can review the calls later on and find out which medics might be acting inappropriately and deal individually with individual problems.
Yeah, I was going to say that's QC.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But that's the kind of mindset. You know, there is a simple solution to every complex problem, and it comes in a memo book, and that is just not the way I work at all. I'm about as far in the opposite direction as you can get. But, you know, pain management is also not something that this medic was comfortable with, very much in the there is a reason for the Mother May I protocols, and we must always respect the Mother May I part of the protocol. We had standing orders for an initial dose. I called for treatment beyond that, and unfortunately, the helicopter that came was not comfortable with the amount of morphine the patient had on board, so they didn't give any more. So the patient actually would have had less pain if we had driven the patient to the hospital, because I would have ended up getting orders to give more.
You know what? That's an insane. I just got to say off the side, you know, if you're out there and you're giving morphine, if you're doing pain management, you know, you got to think of how you'd want a family member treated. We have another drug that goes hand in hand with morphine, and if you give too much, well, hey, if you give too much and they stop breathing and they're in a lot of pain, etc., you know, you can help them breathe. If you really are scared.
Have you ever heard of anybody stopping breathing because of EMS giving too much morphine or fentanyl?
No, and that's insane. Yeah, that's the part of the thing that makes me nuts is that, you know, we're still on the tail end of this new era in medicine where they're addressing pain management, but it seems that a lot of people in the field are in the old school of, oh no, my God, you can't
definitely
get morphine.
And a lot of the medical directors are still thinking that way, even some of the newer ones. But the number one treatment for respiratory depression is to get the patient to talk to you, because when they're talking, they're moving air, they're exchanging carbon dioxide for oxygen, and that is all that I've ever seen that needed to be done for very aggressive doses of opioids.
Now, keep, you know, with that said, you know, the other byproduct of morphine is certainly hypotension. So you really have to monitor that. If the patient goes hypotensive, hey, that's a very serious thing, especially in a trauma. But you want to know something? Like at the bottom of every morphine protocol, you have, you know, if respiratory depression or hypotension, go to Narcan. Come on. It's not like you don't have that drug. It's not like you didn't stock it in the morning when you went out and on the job.
Yes, but we should not really thinking that way. We have so many other steps before we get to Narcan.
I agree.
That we're rushing to an ALS solution to what is usually a BLS problem.
Go ahead.
You know, that's something that is one of our big problems in EMS, is we don't teach people to do thorough assessments, to think about their assessment and how much ALS is actually necessary, rather than, oh, the protocol says do this, this, and this. It's not whether it's necessary, it's whether it's in the protocol.
I completely agree with that. And what I was saying, that all else, if all else fails, I should have caveat.
Oh, definitely.
You know, if all else fails. But you're absolutely right. You're the best observation you said is, how many patients have you seen go into respiratory arrest or severe respiratory depression because you gave them morphine?
But you know what?
I had one who had some respiratory depression, and all I needed to do was get her to talk, and she was fine. And I had her mother sitting next to me the whole time, and I told her, you know, in the hospital, stay by her side. If they need to register her, we'll make sure that she's registered so you don't have to leave her. Pay attention to her. If she's not paying attention to you, talk to her. Get her to talk. You know, don't talk at her, but get her to talk to you so that you're getting her to breathe appropriately. And I made very clear to the nurses and the doctors, this is how much morphine I gave. And this is why I gave it. This is what her initial pain was and stuff. But again, this is how much morphine I gave, so you know they would be aware of the potential for the respiratory depression happening again.
So,
and they were aware of how I handled it, and that it didn't require anything more than just talking with the patient.
And I think that brings back to, I think, Tim, as far as communication goes with your partners, especially medic partners, is that's part of it. You know, is where is the treatment stopping and going, and you know, it's letting them know where you stand with things, and them letting you know where they're standing. But
partner, it didn't matter because this was in the ambulance on the way to the hospital because morphine. One of the problems with it is it continues to increase in effect over about 40 minutes. So that's one of the reasons why I like fentanyl. You have the maximum effect much sooner. So it's a lot easier to titrate it to the effect you want. Sometimes we're dropping off the patient at the hospital, and the morphine hasn't even reached its peak effect. And we're going from bouncing the patient around in the back of a truck on a bumpy road to a hospital stretcher that's two or three times as thickly padded as ours and isn't bouncing around.
Yeah.
Unless maybe you're in earthquake territory.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, both you guys, when it comes to stuff like that, as far as treatment issues or even personality issues, where do we stop actually dealing with it on a personal level, where we're talking to our partners one-on-one and speaking to them about the issues that we're having with them regarding treatment like pain management or CHF treatment, stuff like that, and when do we start bringing it more on a professional level where you're educating them, and then even beyond that where you're taking to like a management level where you want to going to management to address the issues that you're having with somebody. You know,
well,
is that
the two medics that I worked with, the other one was hospitalized without any precepting by me, and they both had issues that I felt that they were not good as medics. One just refused to be taught. Said, don't even bother trying to teach me anything. It just doesn't sink in. Like, fine. Then consider a change in career because our patients are too important to be subjected to that. And, you know, management said, well, no, we're going to back up that medic. We see this as something possible. Like, well, medic's favorite, then yeah, that is a bit personal.
Well, you know,
the other medic was one who just had been around forever, as opposed to the new medic. The first one was a new medic, and just did not care about patients, did not recognize respiratory depression, and it was a transport company where we used the CPR vent. You know, the one which just delivers the fixed rate, fixed volume with each breath.
So no FIO setting, something like that?
Not a thing. Yeah, this is just for CPR, just for a patient who's dead, really. Only we used it on intra-facility stuff, and I would tell the nurses and doctors, you need to sedate this patient if I'm going to transport him on the vent. And when they wouldn't, we usually ended up taking them off the vent and bagging them just so we could time ventilation to their breathing. Because they start biting the vent, they can end up in respiratory failure. And this medic was not able to recognize that. Been around 15 years in a busy city and was not able to recognize this. I, the boss, you know, if you give this medic command, he will kill somebody.
Mm. So you
and,
guys, like, have
as it turned out, several of his patients ended up being coded for this very reason, and they kept him.
But you guys have like a mental thing in your head, like you know, okay, I'm going to talk to this guy X amount of times. If he doesn't, you know, start trying to show some type of interest in my point of view, I'm going to have to.
It depends on the response. Yeah.
Well, I think, Jim, that you're, you know, when you said what do you do when they're getting on the call, what do you do after the call, and do you bring in like supervision or do you take it to the next level? And I think the first statement, like what Tim was saying, is you try to communicate with them on the call. If you, you know, as long as you get to the point of do no harm, you know, and you present a united front on the call, you get through that call. If you, you know, obviously, if you have something where you have to have a massive intervention, well, that's going to require, you know, upper level supervision on that call anyway. And then, you know, so the next thing is you say, okay, let me do a call review with this guy. Let me discuss the call and see if there's reception there. And then if you're not, I mean, but what I'm saying is you take it a staged and increasing level of response each go-around. And
I think, too, Josh, the when you point to the facts, and like you said, doing call review, and you're saying, okay, you know, this at this point in the call, you know, I felt this, but you did this. I think it's important to point out to them, give them some type of like research based or some type of you know, qualification as to why you felt it should have been done a different way than they did it, other than just saying, well, you know, I've heard it done this way, or this is the way it's always been done. You know what I mean? And I think that can actually maybe open people's eyes to things, you know, a little bit when they hear that, okay, it's not just you saying it as their partner that's kind of going against the grain or going against what they want to do, but actually give them some type of a qualifier as to why you're feeling that way and as to why you think that, you know, maybe on the next call we should do it this way because, you know, it's at this, you know, this website or in this textbook or whatever.
Absolutely. And I want to highlight one important thing, Jim, is this entire conversation has gone, what do you do with the guy when they're wrong? When you know they're wrong, when everything else, but what do you do when you think they're wrong and you're actually wrong? I mean, there's got to be as much as you're looking for that reception on their end, you have to be open to take a look at your what you're doing as well.
Right, you've got to
have.
There's
a great book along those lines. It's called Being Wrong, Explorations in the Margin of Error, or something along that for the subtitle. Catherine Schultz is the author, and one of the things she talks about is what does it feel like to be wrong? And she goes into talking about when you find out that you're wrong. She says that's not what it feels like to be wrong. That feels like to know after the fact that you had been wrong. But when you're wrong and don't yet know it, what it feels like is being right because you don't know that you're wrong. And we do need to remain open to the possibility that we are wrong all the time. The two cases I described were the two most serious ones I've dealt with. The only times I've felt that the medic should not be in the business. And I know some, you know, medics I would change a lot about, but I wouldn't say they shouldn't be medics. I think that just about everybody can be worked with, whether they get to the point where I would be happy with the way they're doing it, or they get to the point where the employer is happy with what they're doing, or they get to the point where medical command, you know, we're all going to have different ideas of what is good enough. But, you know, we're disagreeing with somebody else on the scene. We've got to try to figure out without interfering with patient care, what is the appropriate thing to do for patient care, for this patient, because the most important thing is the patient.
Right, and try to maintain that united front because that confidence, patient confidence, is a long way to healing the patient.
Yeah, you know, guys, I only got about a minute left, so I just want to end it right there. And I think it's important. We made some important points tonight. And I think sometimes, even with all this communication that we're talking about and trying to, you know, set the boundaries or address things while on the call itself, I think we have to remain flexible and kind of realize you're not necessarily going to change somebody's personality or change somebody's point of view, but maybe, you know, by addressing it, you know, you guys, you know, two people can actually figure out how to work together, you know, with differing points of view, as long as you're not doing any harm to the patient, you're not working outside of you know, your direction and your protocols and things like that. So I think we made some good points tonight. Hopefully people listening in will get a little bit out of it you know, maybe just kind of keep that all that stuff in mind when they're dealing with those partners that may not be the optimal partner or maybe somebody new that they're not really familiar with. And I think maybe taking some of the approaches that we mentioned might actually help them out. So, guys, thanks for joining me tonight. Tim, I know you were driving. We had some background noise. With the driving.
Sorry about that.
You know, I was trying to gauge how many times the tire was turning. I was trying to see how fast you were driving, but I couldn't count the rotations.
Well, did you hear the sirens receding in the background, or were they gaining on me?
No, I didn't hear any of that. I thought I heard a bing at one time. I thought maybe you opened your door at one point.
Yeah, I did. I just got here.
Ah, there we go. All right. Well, guys, thanks a lot for joining me tonight. I appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks for having us.
Hopefully I'll see you next week.
All right.
Sounds
take
good.
All right. Have a good night, guys. Well, everyone, that's it for tonight's Office Hours. Again, thanks for joining me. And as always, hopefully we'll see you next week. Be sure to check out EMSOfficeHours.com for the archive sessions. As always, this is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours. Stay safe.